Hello, and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast, which is the sibling podcast to the popular weekly classic car title. I'm features editor, Chris Hope, and I'm back at our Peterborough headquarters with editor-in-chief, David.
That's not right. Editor-in-chief.
Let's promote it.
Is that all right?
I've been promoted already.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
And I'm also here with our managing editor, James Sadlier.
Why don't I get a promotion? Honestly, I'm going to be Prime Minister next week, you'll see.
Prime Minister Sadlier. Yeah, sure, why not? We'll kick off, as we often do, with an update of our classics. How is everything going in your respective garages, gents?
The Mazda is sat on the driveway waiting for it to be reinsured this week, but I have found a useful tip, which I've tried out, a household dehumidifier in the cabin of my Toyota Aventus, and it's worked wonders. It's made, it smells better, it looks better. So I'm going to try it in the Mazda this week, and I'm hoping after a long, damp winter with even a brand new roof cart stuff, all the elements creeping in. So I'm hoping that a couple of hours with that rigged up to the mains will work wonders on the interior.
Yeah, elements creeping in, animals creeping in. You've not had any more sort of feline sort of
people. No animal incursions in the Mazda, thankfully, but certainly you know, it's had its fair share of snow, damp, horrible, dark, wintry nights and all that, and it's probably not going to have done the cabin much good sat out on the drive.
So just for context there, a few weeks ago, David inadvertently left his door open. Black Cat decided to make it its bed for the night, so, and obviously all the bits and pieces you were saying about having to dehumidify was because the elements also worked their way in as well, sort of thing.
Yes,
so.
it was a very stinky Toyota cabin, and not good if you have an allergy to cats. So yeah, so it's hence why I decided to treat the Toyota to some love.
How many bottles of Febreze did you get through?
Many. my local co-op is out of stock.
Oh, brilliant.
How about yourself, James? How's the Polo?
Oh, it's okay. It's had a healthy service at the garage and new spark plugs as well. And I had the reason it went in the first place because the exhaust pipe was hanging off and creating Formula One style sparks down my road as I returned home one evening. But they've attached it quite well enough, but every time on like really kind of low revs, I can hear like a metallic kind of,
yeah,
something's not fixed properly in there. So frustrating, we're going to have to take it back.
Yeah, but not having a four-post lift at home is the drawback there, isn't it? Where you, yeah, can get up and sort it yourself.
Yeah, and he was really good, actually, the mechanic. He was, you guys all know where I got a little ding in the bumper.
Mm-hmm. And just the rear corner, isn't it?
Yeah.
The passenger side.
And he tried to knock it out, but equally, he was very helpful in showing me how to take the bumper off so I can do it myself. Mm. So I'm going to do your trick and get some hot, take the bumper off and get some hot boiling water on it to see if I can massage it out.
Yeah. Yeah, just don't do it cold because it'll crack.
It'll
sort
crack.
Of thing,
so. Yeah, I think that's probably the best thing. But David said, like, didn't you? That you can't really see it, but I know it's there, and I think everyone's like that with their.
I think
cars.
It's one of those, if you know something's there, it doesn't matter how nice people are, but you can't unsee it.
Yeah, because you know, no one knows your own car better than you do, though. Yeah. And it's sometimes it's your pride and joy. It's any blemish. And he was talking to me about polishing it, because it's got a very kind of, the red has got, it's an 80s red, and it's faded a bit. And so I was talking to him about kind of different polishes. He gave me some really good advice. He said a lot of mistakes people do is with those electronic kind of polishers.
The orbital ones.
Orbital ones.
Yeah.
They just go, they whack it on the highest setting straight away, go whatever, and it takes off yeah. all the layers without even that much effort.
No.
So that's my one piece of advice for this week early on in this podcast.
Mm, okay, cool.
How about you? How's it going with the Mini?
Oh, there's nothing to report. Everyone's fully aware of how disgusting the roads are at the moment. I don't want to expose the Mini's underside to salt, grime and everything else. Apart from, you know, having to sort of crawl underneath with a jet washer Lancer, it's going to be a waste of time sort of thing. So yes, it's tucked away. I'm actually involved in the story that we're going to be discussing now. Our lead story in our this week's issue relates to enthusiast backing belts in classics. So a month ago, we did a new story on the Federation of British Historic Vehicle Clubs, which is the umbrella organisation that looks after all of the UK's car clubs. They raised concerns about roadside cameras detecting occupants not using seatbelts and how this could catch out some owners of pre-1965 cars, which aren't obligated to have seatbelts, but could potentially still be issued fines. David, I'm going to actually hand over to you now, and you can sort of tell us a little bit more about this, because from the sample of enthusiasts that we spoke to, a lot of people are in favour of fitting belts. It's a case of going sort of, you know, safety over originality.
Not only in favour, but, you know, in many cases, they've actually done that. They've actually taken their pre-1965 cars, which aren't legally required to be fitted with belts because they never left the factory with them originally, but they've taken the decision consciously to retrofit them for safety reasons. Mm-hmm. And it is very interesting because there are many thousands of pre-65 cars out there. And, you know, you can take it through, you know, they're exempt from MOTs, of course, but if you do submit them, there's no legal requirement for them to have belts.
Yeah.
But what we found from enthusiasts who've been reading CCW is they've been telling us overwhelmingly that, if they haven't fitted them already, they would strongly consider doing so because they prioritise safety over originality. I think the days of certainly the prevailing view in the 50s and 60s was that it was better in the case of an accident to be thrown clear of the car. But obviously we've had all sorts of evidence now to show that many lives have been saved by seatbelts.
Yeah.
And I think it would be a pretty precious Concord judge who would mark a car down for being fitted with seatbelts. And certainly I would much rather, if I had something like a Ford Zodiac or an Austin A40, I would much rather head home with a couple of points docked off my Concord list for having a seatbelt fitted than I would have an accident on the way home and be regretting the consequences much later on.
Yeah. And for the benefit of listeners, when we are talking about roadside cameras, what are they? Where are they? Sort of general sort of CCTV? Is it the sort of cameras that are used for smart motorways? Is it a bit of everything?
So these are cameras that are being fitted primarily on trunk roads by 10 different police forces across the country, and they use AI. They were trialled in the Devon and Cornwall constabulary area, and the idea with them is that they can look and they can look at you as you're driving your car, and they can work out using AI whether you're wearing a seatbelt or not. And they work in the dead of night. It's they're very clever bits of kit, but not clever enough, it seems, to be able to look at a registration number and tell whether it was registered, because if that was the case, you would be able to discount anything made before 1965, and that would discount the issue of pre-65 car owners being issued prosecutions.
Yeah.
That's a stroke.
Do you think that's the next step then? If it's that clever and they can implement that tech, all it takes is one look at the letter of the law and say, right, that's the next thing we need to do in the progress of this technology.
I would like to hope so, but I mean, I've seen enough AI clips of people with six fingers and fake mouths on the internet that I'm not entirely sure in my faith in AI to distinguish correctly between the two even now.
Mm. There's one thing I would add, though, on the concourse argument is that, to mark a car down because it's got aftermarket seatbelts on, it's just it seems silly to me. I think, okay, it does take away from that originality, absolutely, but I don't think you should punish someone.
It depends
for
what you're
safety.
Using your car for, in my opinion. So if it is that we're talking about a car that is purely used for these kind of events, it's trailered to these events, it lives a very costed life as part of a collection, then I think yes, but that's not really what we're talking about here, is it? Yeah, we were talking about cars that are used more regularly, sort of thing. So I, as I say in my comment, just see it as part and parcel of improvements that you make to make car more reliable. It's in line, to my mind, with things like improving the lighting so that you can drive at night more safely, sort of thing. I think it is. It's just doing everything that you can to mitigate risk. Ultimately, you know, by the safety standards of today, all of these classics that fall into that pre-65 bracket are not going to be up to muster. My Mini, I really wouldn't fancy my chances in a crumple test, sort of thing. It's not going to be pretty. There's nothing you can do about that, but it is a step that you can take to just lower that risk sort of thing. So,
and I think there is an element of it's down to individual choice and being sympathetic to the particular type of car that you're fitting. You, if you had a Bugatti Type 35 in the garage or a 50 Formula One car, then I think most people would probably say that you're bonkers to fit that with a Britax seatbelt. But if you're using something like your Mini or I don't know, a Ford Console or something like that, and you're using it not massively regularly, but you know, you're using
classic cars get used 1,000 miles a year on
that's
average.
What I mean.
That's
if
still
if
enough
you're
to
driving,
be a risk.
If you're driving it in modern traffic conditions and there are plenty of other survivors out there, I don't think anyone's going to look down on you for fitting your car with seatbelts.
No, and within the story itself, we look at examples whereby, just sort of adding to that point, that we're not advocating that every single classic car is fitted with seatbelts. You can't fit seatbelts to a Didion Bouton sort of thing from the turn of the century sort of thing. And the example that we've got here is a Lancia Appia where the B posts just don't allow for 3-point belts to be fitted sort of thing. So there is a degree of sensibility. It has to be cars that are compatible with this technology.
Yes.
You know, and there's plenty of pre-war cars where you won't be able to do that sort of thing. So it's an interesting sort of conversation, I think. I think it's one that can potentially sort of rumble on. I think I'd be really keen to see what the police can do to sort of, you know, remove these cars from being picked up by cameras. I know that AI is evolving all the time. One less headache sort of thing. One more question, David. What sort of fines typically are people being given if they are being picked up by these cameras?
Oh, goodness, I don't have the...
I do not. Okay. Sorry.
The fines guideline in front of me, unfortunately.
Cool. Well, we'll just move on past that in a jersey. Sorry about that.
I was going to say, though... for me, if it was me and my classic, I would always put the seatbelt in just because the amount of times it's not just you, it's other people around you on motorways. I mean, I know I'm kind of stating the obvious here, but that safety aspect of worrying about someone else going into you, it does beg the question, what's next? They're doing seatbelts. Is technology going to expand into being able to fit airbags into certain classics? Maybe not.
It's a balancing act, isn't it? So
I think one of the really important points as well is that classic car owners are a conscientious bunch. We take pride in our cars, we take pride in our driving, and we know that the accident rates for classic cars are far lower than the sort of the wider public, so which is part of the reason why classic car insurance policies are so much cheaper than mainstream ones. The issue you have is I think more typically is if someone else hits you.
Yeah.
You don't want to be in a situation where you pull out of a junction, someone hasn't seen you, and you end up being hit at the backside or in the side. You potentially get quite serious injuries or worse because someone else hasn't been paying attention. I think that's why seatbelts in this day and age are obviously seen as quite important by enthusiasts.
Yeah, agreed. Well, that was our lead news story. Of course, our news section is chock full of other stories as well. One of the ones that caught my eye was that Cheshire-based auction specialist Manor Park Classics, they're expanding. So they're now going to have a base in the south. David, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I mean, in a nutshell, they have bought Barons, which for listeners, they may be familiar with Barons being quite a well-established auction house down in Southampton. They've been trading since 1998, and their very first lot was a charity lot, which I believe was auctioned by Tiff Nadell of Top Gear fame. And they have, you know, evolved and changed over the years. They specialised originally holding sales, particularly at Sandown Park Racecourse, and they did quite well with classic Jaguars, but they moved, particularly as the pandemic arrived, into holding sales on a monthly basis at a fixed warehouse that they own in Southampton. And that's done them reasonably well over the years. But the thing that attracted Manor Park to them was that it's a very similar setup to what they're doing up in Runcorn. And that's where that this deal has come up. And it's essentially meant that Manor Park, who have been holding sales since 2021, are now able to have their own base in the south of England, as well as the one in the north of England. And the thing that interests me about this particular deal is that when I spoke to Stephen Ashworth, their chairman, about it, is that it's not just that one deal. It's part of a much bigger ambition to open up other bases across other parts of the UK. And ultimately, their aim is to have selling classics to everyone in the UK, which will be a really interesting development for the classic car market.
We've seen quite a shift over the past decade, whereby you know, some of the fears with buying at auction have sort of been allayed. We've seen sort of video walkarounds during the pandemic being introduced. It's a lot more normal to buy a car through auction now than it perhaps was 10 years ago. So, and Manor Park has sort of established themselves as one of the companies that just really helps hold your hand through the process, sort of thing. They have their purpose-built sort of facility in Runcorn, as you say. We were there last week. I was impressed by the huge lift that they have that you can sort of use to sort of observe the underside of the cars and things like that. I mean, in a nutshell, why is this good for enthusiasts?
I think certainly auctions have become a lot more mainstream over particularly the past decade or so. It used to be, I remember sort of, you know, in Classic Car Week, these early days. I mean, yeah, there have always been individual enthusiasts buying at auctions, but in the past there was always a reputation that they were a lot more trade focused. But nowadays, you know, auctions are very much catering to the likes of you and me, the average classic car enthusiast, as opposed to sort of, you know, people more from the trade. And Manor Park has played a big part in that. They have very detailed listings of documents. They have video overviews of cars. They have Paul Cowland, who listeners might be familiar with. He's a presenter on Salvage Hunters Classic Cars. He will pick out cars and talk about those. So a lot of work has gone in from Manor Park and other auctioneers too in really trying to mainstream the auction process. And I think actually a big part of that was the pandemic. There was that stage where Boris Johnson, he said, you know, you've all got to stay indoors. For the occasional jog or for your jog to the shops, if you will. But and there was this moment nearly 5 years ago where auctionists thought, crumbs, what are we going to do? But actually it really turbocharged and moved towards having a lot more being offered online, more video offerings, better pictures. And I think actually that a lot of that will be brought to what, you know, was the existing Barron's operation. And I think you'll see a lot more on the South Coast of this very online, digital focused way of selling. So I think actually that is a good thing. If you're looking to buy a car in the south of England, I think it will give you more power and more information before you go ahead and buy a car. The thing I would always say, and I'm sure Manor Park would agree with this, is to go along and look at the car as well before you take the plunge. They've been really quite positive out here. You talked about their ramp that they had before. If you're not sure about a car, they can put it up on a ramp for you. I know that other auctioneers, again, they will happily go round a car with you to kind of show you its sort of its various nooks and crannies. And I think actually it gives you more information and helps you make it, anything that helps you make a more informed buy is a good thing for enthusiasts.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things which Stephen mentioned when I interviewed him was he mentioned that he, in his view, he thinks that auctions will take over more from classic car dealerships.
Right.
I'd be interested to see how that plays out in the long run, but certainly, the days of sort of auctions being seen as kind of quite stuffy, forbidding places for a lot of enthusiasts, I think those days are gone. And actually, we've seen that in the number of cars being bought and sold at auctions. They're going up year on year. So I think it's going to be a really interesting development for the UK's classic car market.
And just, you know, talking about auctions more generally, it's not just the buying process. I know, James, you've been through the selling process recently.
Yeah, and I felt really reassured by it. I think there's like you both just spoken about, there's a lot more kind of trust in buying at auction now than there ever was before. And even to the point, to David's point, you know, recommended going and like looking around a car when I was at the auction where you bought your Mini, Chris, and obviously at my auction where I sold my Classic, and the amount of people that were buying using the information that the auction house was supplying digitally was I think quite reassuring for people, and people were buying without actually seeing it in person. There was that number seems to be growing, especially those people who just can't make the trip from, say, I don't know, Cornwall to Norfolk, I suppose. But you know, I'd like to think most of us would go along and have a look around a car and find something like. But I must admit, it's fantastic for employment as well in our hobby as well. It's, you know, kind of Barron's kind of expanding like this and looking at their longer term plan, it's just going to open up more jobs to people who are really interested in getting to...
Yeah, Manor Park Classics purchase of Barron's, but yeah, I do believe that they are looking to take on stuff.
Barron's existing team will be kept in play, and their existing sale dates, which are on their websites, are being maintained. But certainly, the ambition from Manor Park's point of view is to eventually move it to a bigger warehouse, or I think warehouse probably won't count, a bigger base to sell cars from, so that they can offer the same kind of services and scale of cars that they're already doing in Runcorn. And they've talked as well about having another base in the North London area to cater for places, sort of the M40 belt, Oxfordshire, Reading, those kind of that part of the world, and another base up in Scotland and Central Belt, which will obviously cater for Edinburgh, Glasgow, Southern Scotland, places like Carlisle and Newcastle as well, to an extent. And it's interesting because that then raises the idea that could it be that in future you could have auction houses almost running sort of across the country. You almost have a Tim Hortons style chain of different auction houses across the country. That potentially could be the future. I don't know.
I think it depends, doesn't it? I think that, as I said, auctions are becoming far more mainstream. I don't think it's unusual. I'm sure there's listeners that will have sort of bought multiple cars and sold multiple cars through auctions. Where the auction companies come into their own is the trust that they develop with those people and have those returning customers, sort of thing. So I know that there'll be people out there who will trust particular brands and will sort of swear by them regardless of their geographical sort of location. People move around just as cars do, sort of thing. So, I think Manor Park in particular, working hard to build that trust with its potential customers and returning customers, aren't they, sort of thing.
So. And they place a lot of importance on the customer experience. So again, it's not just a case of you turn up in a sheepskin jacket on a freezing cold day, in some unheated cow shed somewhere. For them, it's very much around a customer facing experience. Lots of opportunities to check the car. You sit there down over a coffee in a nice, lovely, warm office and look through paperwork. And again, making it more mainstream. And I think a lot of what they've built up as their particular model in Runcorn, that's what they're looking to bring to the South Coast and to other parts of the UK as well.
Well, Manor Park are holding their next sale on Saturday the 15th, so that's next Saturday.
14th and 15th of Feb, so they have a 2-day sale, one for bikes, one for cars.
Yeah, so that's coming up. In our February 5th issue, we do preview that auction, so if you are interested in Manor Park and the cars that are going to be in their potential sale, then obviously we would encourage you to have a look in our auction section this week and see what there is.
Barron's is also coming up this weekend as well, 8th of Feb as well, so again, have a look through some interesting cars coming through there too. So
that will be their final sale under as Barron's.
Yeah, so effectively that is, if you go to Barron's this weekend, you will start to see banners with the Manor Park branding on.
Right.
So it's the start of a sort of a new era for Barron's.
Fair enough. Well, gentlemen, busy, aren't we? As usual, working on a weekly title. Before we go away, I'd just like to sort of do a bit of a preview of what's coming up next week. So
yeah, it's going to be a good 12. Issue.
Yeah, it's one of our special upsized issues. So bigger pagination and an overarching theme, which is the future of classic motoring. So there's various things that we're going to be looking at, including how event organisers are changing established formats for their shows to attract new visitors, how Goodwood has made the switch to sustainable fuel for its races, and also we were at the British Motor Museum to look into one of their new initiatives. Just want to mention a little bit about that, David, before we sign off.
It's going to be a good read because there's lots of different things happening that our classic car hobby has evolved all the time, and there are different people coming in. There's new changes in technology, different events, and so on. And this is going to be a really comprehensive look at the big things that are happening affecting our hobby and how you can get involved with them.
I'm really looking forward to this time next week when we can talk about it a little bit more. For now, though, David, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome, thank you.
And James, thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
We'll see you soon. Bye.